Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast and to this episode 4 of our mini-series on the maritime history of Sweden. We've already been on a tour of Stockholm's National Maritime Museum and we've heard about Swedish Vikings in Arab lands and we've heard about Sweden's naval history from 1500 onwards and how it influences the present day. But today we're heading back in time again, this time to the 18th century, to find out all about one of maritime Sweden's most interesting characters, Fredrik Henrik af Chapman. Born in Gothenburg in 1721 to immigrant English parents, his father had served in the Swedish Navy before becoming a manager of a shipyard in Gothenburg. His mother was the daughter of a London shipwright. He was, therefore, born into a life of ship design and construction, and he was just 10 when he designed his first vessel. By 23, he ran his own shipyard, maintaining and repairing Swedish East Indiamen. This was a period when the science of shipbuilding reached new heights, and Chapman, uniquely a mathematician and a shipwright, led the way. He is considered to be the grandfather of naval architecture. Mathematicians who studied shipbuilding lacked the practical skill to implement their own ideas, while shipwrights lacked the mathematical understanding. The first person who combined these two skills was Fredrik af Chapman. Chapman made it possible to predetermine and assess mathematically different attributes of vessels, such as stability and sailing qualities. To find out more, I sat down in the library of Sweden's National Maritime Museum with one of their curators, Jonas Hedberg. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoy talking with him. Here is a man jam-packed with juicy facts. It's Jonas. Jonas, tell us where we are. It's probably best coming from you.
Yeah, we're in the library of the Swedish National Maritime Museum in Stockholm. And this space hasn't changed very much since 1938 when it opened. This is one of Scandinavia's largest libraries for maritime literature.
It's amazing. It's a classic library in that there are books that go all the way up to the ceiling and all the way around. There've got to be thousands of books in here. I'd like to spend some time in here. Now, we're just sitting down next to a display case, and there's a very special book in that display case, and it's the subject we're going to be talking about. Let's begin by talking about this special book in the display case. Jonas, what's that?
Yeah, well, this is a copy of the Holy Scripture, which used to belong to Fredrik Henrik af Chapman, who's the single greatest name in Swedish shipbuilding history.
Yeah.
One would have to say.
How did you get, we'll go on and talk about him, but how did you get his Bible and why have you got his Bible?
Well, it was donated to us a couple of years back and it's on display here for the time being at least. And it's interesting to look at his notes on some of the pages, which sort of give you a slight inkling that he wasn't very religious himself.
Right.
Necessarily.
Scrawling all over his own book.
Yeah.
I have to say that annotations in historic books, particularly Bibles, I think, are absolutely fascinating. Was he writing about the scriptures, or was he just doodling about boats?
He made some remarks which weren't necessarily in line with religious dogma at the time.
Right. Okay, that's fascinating. Now, we've had a lovely walk around the museum this morning looking at your extraordinary collection of ship models, which are actually going to feature very soon in the Lloyd's Register Foundation's project Maritime Innovation in Miniature. So I'd urge you all to make sure you Google that and go and find that. And there are we're going to be filming one of the Chapman ships. And there was also a beautiful little model made by Stefan, your resident model maker. How long have you had a resident model maker in the museum?
Well, ever since the beginning, actually. There used to be at least 5 or 6 of them.
Really?
Yeah. And now we're down to 1, but we're very happy to still have him.
Yeah, and he has his own model-making studio, which I've been blessed to go into.
Yes, he does. It's very exciting to visit.
Yeah, the most remarkable tools and an extraordinary job. So on the desk of Stefan's workshop at the minute is a very beautiful example of a Swedish warship from the 18th century, which was made by Frederick Henrik af Chapman. So let's talk a little bit about him. Who was he? Why was he so brilliant?
Well, Chapman is really unique in Swedish maritime history because he was a bit of an upstart, really.
Okay.
Yeah, he was at odds with the traditional Swedish shipbuilding establishment, which at the time, during the 1700s, was dominated by a family of British descent called the Sheldons, and they had sort of monopolized naval shipbuilding for at least 40 or 50 years.
Mm. And Chapman's a very distinctively English name. So was he English? Was he Swedish? What's going on there?
Well, he was born to British parents who immigrated to Sweden in the early 1700s. So there was a strong shipbuilding tradition in the family. So there was a bit of infighting, I suppose, going on between Chapman and the Sheldon family. About who would get the lucrative contracts and
right
assignments.
Yeah.
So did Chapman learn his craft in England or in Sweden?
He did learn his craft in England to a great extent. He visited London for a number of years in the 1740s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent time at the Royal Dockyards.
Okay.
Which would have been Woolwich.
Yeah.
Deptford. Chatham.
Yep.
And he learned, picked up a lot of knowledge there, and he collected a vast number of line drawings and plans. And actually he was arrested by the authorities.
I'm not surprised. What happened to him?
Well, he was put under house arrest for a month, and he was they suspected him to be a French spy.
Mm. French, not Swedish.
Yeah, interestingly enough, because he was London was only one of the stops on his grand tour of
right.
Europe, and he was headed for Brest,
okay,
a French naval base.
So yeah.
that would have made him a bit suspicious in the eyes of the British authorities, I guess.
It makes you wonder what would happen to someone who stole the plans for a British warship now, and I promise you, you wouldn't be put under house arrest for a month.
No, likely not.
You'd be in some fairly serious trouble. But yeah. That kind of highlights the point about the exchange of ideas. It was more of a slap on the wrist, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But he was very, very eager to learn, very curious. And above all, he had this ambition of applying advanced science,
right,
which hadn't been done to such a great extent before in
okay.
shipbuilding.
which is surprising, saying that this is the 1740s, 1750s. That's, you know, relatively late to suddenly decide to embrace advanced mathematics and advanced science for shipbuilding, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, shipbuilding in Sweden and also, I think, Britain to a great degree during this period relied on sort of incremental right. change rather than any wild experiments.
Yeah.
And Chapman had seen how wrong things, how long it could take for a ship of a line to be actually completed.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to...
So that about 10 years, a bit longer?
Could be upwards of 10 years, yeah.
Yeah.
In Sweden, at least.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd assume that the knowledge of how to design and how to build, things move so quickly in our modern world.
Yeah. But his ambition was to streamline the whole process.
Right.
And get things done more efficiently and cheaply.
Yeah. And was he successful?
Yes, you would have to say that he was, actually. He was put in charge of a naval rearmament program in the 1780s in Karlskrona, which is this naval base in the south of Sweden.
Yeah.
And he built 10 ships of the line, which were fairly small, two-deckers, 60 gunners, and 10 frigates.
10? That's an awful lot, isn't it?
In the space of 3 years. So that's with a very constrained budget.
He built all of those ships in 3 years?
Yeah. So that's a pretty massive feat for the time.
Yeah, it must have been an immense amount of manpower.
Yeah, yeah. And these ships went on to serve in the Russo-Swedish War of 1788-90 and performed really well in themselves. The problems were more on the level of inept high command and lack of skilled crews.
Was that a problem that had bedeviled Swedish maritime history, or was that a new problem in the 1780s?
No, I think it would be safe to say that the problem of finding skilled, seasoned seamen that was something that appeared every now and then.
Mm.
That was a distinct disadvantage compared to the Danish-Norwegian navy, which had better access to seasoned.
Was it the Danes who had a rude term for the Swedish sailors?
Yes, they condescendingly referred to Swedish sailors as peasants dipped in salt water.
What's
a really nasty thing to say.
It is a really nasty thing to say.
Perhaps there's a grain of truth to that, after all.
Mm, yeah. And the British also had a presence in the Baltic in the 18th and the early 19th century. Did they come across Swedish naval power? What do they think of the Swedes?
Yeah, well, they entered the Baltic in 1808, I believe, to assist Sweden against the Russians, which we were at war with at the time. So we were allies in the Baltic. And I honestly don't think the Royal Navy was very impressed with the state of the Swedish Navy at the time, because a huge proportion of Swedish crews fell ill with scurvy and other diseases, which surprised the British. But I think they were surprised that not enough measures were taken to prevent disease.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a backward...
backward step.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, with the sailing navy. It's something that I realised very early on when I was writing about it, is how visible competence is, and you can't hide from it. So it's all to do with the performance of a ship at sea, even down to how quickly and efficiently the sails are brought in or reefed or whatever it might be. So
yeah.
For the British, it would have been very clear That there was a problem with the Swedish Navy.
Yeah.
But the ships were good, weren't they? We'll come back to Chapman again.
Yeah, the ships were really good. They were designed to be able to navigate in shallow waters and to deal a swift, decisive blow to the Russians or the Danish, just sailing into the naval bases at Kronstadt or Copenhagen, just to be able to sort of sweep in
Like a lightning attack.
A lightning attack, yeah.
Is that what we're talking about?
That wasn't really realistic because as it happened, the Russian Navy refused to stay in port.
They didn't play the same game.
No. So what happened was there was a bit of a slogging match at sea. And there the Swedish Navy was at a disadvantage because the Swedish ships were smaller and couldn't withstand prolonged artillery duels, as well as the Russian ones, which were larger.
Mm. The model that's down on Stefan's workshop that we are going to film and that we looked at, which type of vessel is that?
That's an East India man.
Ah. So he was designing for other people as well?
Yeah, well, naval ships were only part of his production, and he designed quite a number of ships for the Swedish East India Company,
right,
which was quite active in the late 1700s and into the 1800s.
Yeah, it was an interesting vessel. So it has a great deal of space on board, obviously for trade and some gun ports, but not as many as you'd find on a normal warship.
No, they were more for show, I would imagine. I mean, there was always the need to defend yourselves against privateers, and it's not a by any means a heavily armed ship.
No, but he's certainly building a ocean going ship that isn't just for service in the Baltic. That's the difference, isn't it? So
yeah.
The naval ships were purely for service in the Baltic, but here he's building an East India one, which is that's got to cope with the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, isn't it?
Yeah, but apparently they did really well. And were really, really good sailing qualities. And Chapman was really good at promoting himself. So he published a number of works in English and French.
Oh, right. I'd like to read those. What are they called?
The most internationally known one would be the treatise on shipbuilding.
Yeah.
Which was published somewhere in the 1770s, I think.
The other aspect, so the ship we're talking about, the East Indiaman, is a large three-masted square-rigged vessel. You can't spend any time at your wonderful museum without realising that Sweden has a long tradition of oared craft, galleys as well. Did he build any of those, or is that something that he didn't get involved in?
Well, yes, indeed, he did. When he returned from France and England in the late 1750s, he was hired by the Crown.
Mm.
And his first assignment was to come up with new types of amphibious craft for the Swedish archipelago navy.
Okay.
Which was a unique arrangement at the time because it was independent from the high seas navy.
Where was it based?
It was based mainly in Stockholm and also on Sveaborg. And in Stralsund, in Swedish Pomerania, which was a Swedish possession at the time. So he came up with four main types of hybrid vessels. I guess you could call them, they had sails, but had oars as well.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to navigate in shallow, confined waters. And the idea was to get something better than these pretty antiquated galleys that Sweden had depended on.
This sounds like some kind of Mediterranean warfare. It's reminding me of the galleasses, they're called, which they were used at in the Spanish Armada, and also of the amazing vessels that the Venetians had.
Yeah, there's a direct lineage
between
the galleasses and the vessels which were used in the Baltic during the Great Northern War.
Okay.
Because that's something that Russia pioneered in the Baltic.
Right.
They lifted the idea from the Venetians, and then they raided the Swedish coastline in 1719 and for a couple of years after that.
So how were these vessels armed?
They were lightly armed. They had huge crews, not a lot of firepower, but they were very effective because they could evade frigates and ships of alliance, and
yeah,
seagoing vessels, and they could land troops, which would then torch every building in sight and quickly move on to the next.
Terrifying.
Yeah, this was something that left its mark on the Swedish national conscience for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised there. It actually reminds me of the Viking raids on England, where previously living by the sea was quite a nice thing, and there was a living to be earned. You could get your food, and suddenly being by the sea was the most dangerous place you could possibly be.
Exactly. And so there was an acute, urgent need to counter this. And the first thing the Swedes did was to build their own galleys. But during the Seven Years' War, it was realized that this wasn't really the most effective type of vessel.
Mm.
So Chapman came up with four main types of archipelago frigates, or at least that's the term that's been used later on. They weren't frigates by any real means, but two of the types were heavily armed and were able to inflict really severe casualties on Russian galleys.
Right.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
And as it turned out, they were a bit of a disappointment when used in actual battle, because they weren't really mobile enough. So they were gradually replaced by smaller vessels, also of Chapman's design. And these were gunboats and gun sloops. And they were even copied by the French. I think Napoleon had this idea of using gunboats of the same type to invade England, basically.
Right, okay. So his influence was European-wide. And the use of advanced maths and science to inform the techniques of shipbuilding design is really interesting, because you and I went to the Vasa Museum yesterday, and here's a ship which... built in the 1620s, is that correct? And that would have been built and designed in a completely different way. Should we just talk a little bit about that? What do we know about how the Vasa was designed?
Well, it was designed partly by royal decree. The king had decided on the rough measurements.
Had he? Did he know anything about ship design?
Of course, he didn't know the first thing about shipbuilding, which was a big part of a problem. But it's probably saved a couple of heads because nobody could really be held to account when the trial took place, because the king, Gustavus Adolphus, had signed the orders himself.
Yeah. Let me just jump in here, and for those of you who don't know, the Vasa is the extraordinary 17th century warship that sank on her maiden voyage and was raised by the Swedes and is now in the Vasa Museum in Stockholm. And there is a separate podcast episode on the history of the Vasa, so you should all listen to that, give you a bit of background information. It developed from medieval ship design, oral tradition.
Well, in the case of the Vasa, it was built by Dutch shipbuilders.
Oh, we blame the Dutch? Is that what you guys do?
Yeah, as you do.
Very good. Blame the king and blame the Dutch.
Yeah.
So they didn't use line drawings or plans in the modern sense, but carried on from previous designs, and the first plans that we have in our collections are from the late 1600s.
Okay.
1690, so very
like 70 years after the Vasa.
Yeah. So before that it was very touch and go.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, because you've recently, a very exciting discovery, you found the Vasa's sister ship. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was a ship that was launched slightly after the Vasa, and it was called Äpplet in Swedish, which is the apple. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, she was launched in 1629, and obviously they weren't really interested in repeating the same catastrophe. So this ship was a bit wider.
Okay, so
enough to make her a not really successful sailing vessel, but she
didn't sink on her first voyage.
She remained afloat for at least 35 years.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good career.
So she was sunk outside Stockholm as a
blockading ship.
Yeah, exactly. That was done for a couple of hundred years. You sank old warships to hinder.
Yeah, enemy
shipping.
But that's something which you guys are particularly suited to, because of the shallowness of the sea, but also the narrowness of the inlets. So you can easily block, and you can relatively easily block. And I think the Europeans, British and French, went through a process of having chains, which were useless. I think, as far as I can work out, they spent an enormous amount of time building these things, but were fairly easy to break.
Yeah, this was sort of a narrow entrance to Stockholm, which was fairly easy to block off in that way.
There's a long tradition of that, isn't there? There's somewhere in Denmark where they found some Viking ships which had been sunk. I forget what they're called now. Do you know which ones I'm talking about? It's a collection of Viking ships which were found sunk at the entrance to a fjord.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
Yeah. I think they're in the Viking Ship Museum in Denmark.
Yeah.
Currently.
Ships would probably be stripped of most fittings and stuff. It's really well preserved. And so it's easy. It's really interesting to think about what the Vasa would have looked like if she had ever had a successful sailing career.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. It's a brilliant place to leave it. Jonas, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, do please make sure that you leave us a review on whatever app that you're listening on, especially if you're listening on iTunes. I promise I'll read out any review that you leave. It's hugely important to help us climb up the rankings and get as many people as possible listening to the podcast. We've got a brilliant YouTube channel with some truly remarkable videos there. Most recently, the animation of a cutaway of a 17th century first-rate man of war, explaining all of the amazing technology inside a remarkable warship of the period. The podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and Lloyd's Register Foundation, so please make sure you do everything you can to check out what those brilliant institutions are up to. In particular, please check out Maritime Innovation in Miniature. Just Google it, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, and you'll see the world's best ship models filmed in the most extraordinary high definition. It really is amazing. And please join the Society for Nautical Research. You can find them at snr.org.uk. It's a brilliant way of supporting the podcast, but also of finding out about all sorts of wonderful maritime history. It really is a very good idea and worth doing.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.